Hi, you're listening to the FPS podcast. This episode draws on the knowledge of one of the most experienced people in our industry and learns about what's happening for people at the start of their career journey. That's coming up right after this message from our sponsors.
Geofirma, practically minded, trusted geotechnical and civil engineers, making the ground safe for infrastructure, residential and commercial projects, big and small, across the UK. Geofirma is a niche geotechnical consultancy specialising in the design of bored pile foundations, retaining walls, both bored and sheet piles, ground investigation delivery and geotechnical interpretation. With a solid reputation, Geofirma works with a wide range of clients, managing the whole geotechnical cycle from planning and ground investigation through to design and construction supervision of geotechnical structures. To deliver its projects, its geotechnical experts use innovative design methods, including both traditional and numerical analysis techniques. Successes include the design of the piled foundations for a 40-storey tower, the largest modular structure in the UK, the design of the board and sheet pile retaining wall for the basements of the prestigious Battersea Power Station project Phase 3 in London, and the design of a stabilisation scheme to increase the design life of a 150-year-old Victorian brick arch reservoir, which supplies 1 million people with water in northwest London. Geofirma prides itself in providing its clients with safe, cost-effective, practical and innovative ground solutions tailored to its clients' specific requirements. Learn more at geofirmaconsultants.co.uk. Geofirma, designing, investigating and supervising geotechnical consulting engineers.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Federation of Partner Specialists podcast. Today, I'm joined by experienced ground engineering professional Nirmal Tiwari and David Major, head of the FPS Early Careers Group. First, let's talk to David about what's happening with the Early Careers Group. David, hi.
Afternoon, Steve. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks. Good to have you back. The first time that we've had a returnee guest. So obviously the first experience went well for you.
Yeah, definitely. Is it a hat-trick ball after the third?
Yeah, quite possibly. Well, I think I said when you first came on, it would be great to continue to have you back, to let people know really what is happening with your group and get people excited about the Early Careers Group and engagement within the FPS. I know there's been a couple of events that have happened over the last few months since we had the podcast it was Tony Suckling, wasn't it, and Fatigue Science as well. We're on the call. Bring us up to date with what's been going on.
Yeah, so we're quite a busy period over the summer. We've had a talk from Keller. Paul Marsden presented to us as an early career group, a bit of a CPD style talk on the different grouting techniques that are out there, their application, what ground conditions they used. And this was very much a theme that the early careers group members wanted to hear. They wanted to learn more about the industry and more about techniques which aren't carried out every day within their own businesses. So get a wider appreciation of what the FPS carries out. So we had the talk from Keller, and then last week we had John Ball from Roger Bullivant give us a lowdown on the recent ground survey that was carried out into the SI work that's ongoing, and sort of gave us a feel for the findings of that survey and how that information is going to hopefully shape ground investigation going forward. And then moving forward into our next set of events, we've got one coming up on the 1st of October from Mark Sheridan of BAM. He's going to talk to the group about commercial good practices and what to look out for and how we can sort of spread that commercial message from an FPS standpoint in our bids and our way that we're working. And then got a really exciting event in December planned with Barra Equipment, where they're hoping to do like a mini open day for the early careers. And I know, Steve, we're going to get you involved at that event as well and to give a briefing to the early careers group. And really excited about that opportunity. Yeah. And, you know, someone outside of a contracting member of the FPS looking to get integrated into the early careers and really help us understand the the techniques and the machines that we use carrying out ground engineering.
It sounds like a brilliant event. I am excited to be part of that and talk to the group. Can you just remind us who exactly, because we call it Early Careers Group, but actually I think sometimes the title possibly can scare off people that would actually gain a lot from going to those events. So there's still quite a range of ages within that group, isn't there?
Yeah, definitely. It's about the experience and your sort of knowledge in the industry today. And the group was very much set up to help people within the first 15 years of their career within piling, ground engineering, just to try and give them a little bit more exposure to the wider FPS and to gain experience and exposure to people from different companies. So we've had, you know, Phil Hines from Bashy come and give a presentation, John Chick from Expanded, and we're really trying to get a coverage from across the FPS. And the whole group is designed to help people develop in their careers, and it's supported really well by FPS members and the FPS itself. And it's been fantastic. You know, we've had quite a few new people join since we last spoke on the podcast, which is great. It's still growing, still getting lots of interest, and it's been a fantastic experience. And we're hopeful, obviously social distancing allowing, to start to get some face-to-face events going forward and really push that networking. And that's why I'm really excited about the December event, and especially getting yourself involved, Steve, and you to meet the group. You know, it will be fantastic.
Well, for both parties, hopefully. So the sort of numbers, I mean, it's grown, as you say. We're sort of getting up to 20 people at an event, aren't we? And thank you on behalf of the FPS to the people that have put in the time and the effort to prepare the presentations, and particularly with Bauer coming forward and saying that they'll put on this fantastic event. So if people need to find out more, speak to your business leaders. There'll also be messages going out on our LinkedIn page, on our Twitter account as well, and you can find out some more there. So let's now touch on a few industry news items. I thought it'd be a good chance to just have a chat about what's going on. I mean, there's a little project that started officially last week, wasn't there? It's only 45 billion for phase one, London to Birmingham HS2. I mean, this, we've spoken about it before on the podcast. It's such a game changer for the industry. In total, we're looking at 32,000 jobs, plenty of those within the ground engineering sector. One of the headline figures, 2,000 apprentices. Yeah, 51 miles of tunnels, for instance. I know our members don't necessarily directly do tunnels, but I was actually talking to Phil Hines yesterday, and he was saying he's in a joint venture with their parent company Vinci, and they're doing some of the tunneling work, and obviously part of the package is lots of piling work as well. So there's some fantastic schemes coming through. I'm Central Piling, obviously a slightly different focus in terms of our market, not typically doing these sort of very large scale infrastructure projects. It might be slightly different for you guys there at Expanded and Lango Rourke, I suppose.
Yeah, so we've been actually working on HS2 with Murphy and a JV on the enabling works, and people might have seen on the news the bridge that got moved over a weekend. It got quite a lot of press for the speed at which the bridge went in. So yeah, we've been up there over the last 12 months, putting in piles for bridges as part of the enabling works. But you're right, I think the whole industry's got a buzz about HS2. You only need to go on LinkedIn and you're seeing investments in terms of rigs and fleets and D-wall equipment coming into the UK. So it's an exciting time, and especially for them 2,000 apprentices to get involved in a legacy project.
Well, as you say, legacy. I mean, these are the sort of schemes that do get people excited about going into construction, and I think we need more of them. They're great catalysts for growth. We need to be looking past HS2. I know it's very early, and we're looking at opening in 2033. Well, come on, what's next, really? But talking about recruiting, you might have caught the AGS webinar. So the AGS have started doing a few webinars actually, which is a great source of information for us within the Federation of Partnering Specialists as well. And Julian Lovell, their chair, who was hosting it, he was joined by Nick Corr. So Nick Corr is, can't remember call his official title, but he's basically head of geotechnics down at Portsmouth University. And he's got a lot of links to people in the piling industry, and we've at Central Piling we've taken a lot of students from his courses in the past. But he was talking about how much there's been a decline in numbers of students coming in to geoscience. So we're talking geology, we're talking geotechnics, and he was linking it to the number of students doing A-level geology, but also interestingly linking it to the price of oil. So he put up this great graph, and I think it's all still available on YouTube if people want to check it out. And he was saying basically there was one point, and it's sort of a high point 40 years ago, where the price of oil was way up, and there was fantastic opportunities for people in terms of salaries going into that industry. Now the oil prices have started to drop, got less people interested in going into those sort of careers. And also it can be seen as either a dirty industry, so environmentally not good, or it's seen to not represent a wide demographic. So there's that sort of idea of geology students are white middle-aged men wearing jumpers like me. I like a jumper, wandering around the countryside. It's perhaps meaning that we've got quite a narrow appeal for geology and geoscience. And so his proposal within the webinar was to look at something that he termed urban geoscience. So this was more about creating a focus on underground spaces. It was about using more and more technology, so three-dimensional technology, BIM, and looking at the geochemical side of what we do as well, and try and use that sort of appeal to address the decline in people coming in. Now, currently, we've not got, as we stand now, we've not got a great shortage of people in the industry. You know, the employers aren't clambering to get people in. But with HSU, as we mentioned, the picture is going to change quite quickly. And there will be a demand for more students. This idea, and I'd be interested to get David's view, is that this urban geoscience will attract more people, and it will attract people that haven't been represented well in the industry.
Yeah, I think it's great, and I think it's important, like you say, on the back of something like HS2, that we really do market ourselves. And obviously, as an FPS, we've started doing work with the Construction Youth Trust to get into 14 to 18 year olds, so we can help encourage people to take that career in construction, which previously might not have seemed attractive to them. And then with the FPS, we've put structure in place through the forthcoming mentoring scheme, and then with the early careers group, there's a real path there of support for people that come into the industry where historically they might think they're not going to have that and they're going to get lost and they're just a number. But we're trying to get that structure in place so that once we've encouraged them to come in, we're going to hold on to them and retain them. And we've already seen from my early careers group that we've got people now getting involved with subcommittees of the FPS and starting to have a voice within the committee. So I think they're the sorts of messages that once you get in the industry, it's fantastic. You know, you can take on responsibility from a very early stage of your career, and we will encourage you to do that. And badging it as urban geoscience, I think is great. And promoting the work that we're doing with sustainability, making it current and relevant, is only going to encourage people coming into the industry, I think.
Yeah, I'm sure the work that your group are going to do within universities and with the connection with the Construction Youth Trust will help inspire people to come in. I can't help but be excited by the enthusiasm of the people at the Construction Youth Trust. They're a fantastic group of people and do some amazing work with individuals that come from backgrounds that are disadvantaged. So looking at seeing how we can help people that they're associated with, and of course the mentor scheme. Yeah, I mean, I'm so excited about how that's developing. Nirmal actually has already volunteered as a mentor. We've got, I believe, 6 or 7 universities now that have shown support. So I've got a meeting with Loughborough University next week. Portsmouth themselves have volunteered. We've got Leeds, Bradford, Brunel, Hertfordshire. So there's good numbers, and the target in the first year is to get 40 undergraduates and support them and give them industry experience. So it's shaping up nicely. There's a lot of work to do. We're not complacent, and we appreciate that it's going to be involve a lot of hard work from the universities, from the students, and of course from the mentors as well. But it's shaping up nicely, and set us up well for the future. And let's talk about your nomination, David. GE Awards, Grand Engineering Magazine Awards nomination for, remind me of the category.
So, I've been shortlisted under the Rising Star category. I just get in before I turn the wrong side of 30, and it's all downhill. So, last knockings, and I managed to get in. But I think it's great, and it's an opportunity to showcase what we as contractors do. When we look back at the nominations over the last few years, it's been a lot of engineering practices, and we want to make sure we're promoting and people are aware of the great challenges that we face as contractors and how we're overcoming them. So it's great. And it's just another example of showing people what can be achieved, you know, within their career. So I'm really excited about it. It's been a great process, and fingers crossed maybe for the 4th of November.
Interesting that. I mean, tell people about the process, because I think there's been a reluctance from contractors to put forward individuals for that awards process. So demystify it and tell us what's involved, so we can get more of our piling contractors going forward for the awards next year.
Yeah, so it was something that was suggested to me by a couple of people internal. You put together some responses to preset questions, and it's really about showcasing where you've applied yourself to geotechnical challenges, how you're looking to improve and move the industry forward. So we majored on the work that I've been doing with the FPS, and also then how in my day-to-day we tackle the tenders and the opportunities and the projects that are presented to us. You know, I've been fortunate, I've spent time on site, and then I've come back into the office to work in the pre-construction department, and it's just really showcasing that experience and how we've applied ourselves. And it's been great. Unfortunately, this year we didn't get to present to a judging panel like previous years. So thanks COVID for that. Just saved someone listening to an hour of my voice. So someone somewhere was happy about that. But it's great. And it's great exposure. And on the back of that, I've been asked to put together a couple of sound bites for articles that have gone in recent GE magazines as well. So yeah, it's great. And there's nothing prouder than to see your voice and your face in these sort of publications. And it's definitely great for the FPS as well, because it raises awareness of the work that we're all doing. So I would encourage anyone and everyone to put themselves forward for it.
Yeah, I think it shows a real vision for yourself as well, and can help you push on again in your career without wanting to embarrass you. I think you stand a fantastic chance, because you know, the work that you've done, there's not many people in the industry that are putting that much effort at any stage of their career. So for you to do it at the point that you're at, you know, thank you to you, and good luck with your entry. So the Grand Engineering Awards, they've got a variety of awards. They've got things like geotechnical project 1 to 3 million, under 1 million. They've got Contractor of the Year, Consultant of the Year. Anything catch your eye in terms of other awards entries there, David?
Yeah, so looking through the list, obviously things in the equipment innovation, there was a couple of shortlists that caught my eye. There's obviously the Liebherr LB16 Unplugged. That's an obvious one. I was fortunate enough to go to Bauma in 2019 and to see the rig up close. I think it is the future of the industry to have more electric plant, and that's obviously the first piling rig on the market, so that naturally caught the eye.
I got an invite to that and I wish I'd have gone now, because you know, I think you're absolutely right. It is all right, it might not be that particular rig, but that sort of technology has got to be the future for the industry. And it's fair play to Lieber for leading the charge on that one.
And then we've also, there was something very close to the sustainability one from Equip Training. They've got something that's called the Rhino Core Box, and it's a recyclable storage unit that they use when they're collecting site investigation samples. So right off the bat of your article, Steve, about Down to Earth with Zac Efron and looking to be more sustainable. And
thank you for the plug.
You know, looking to be more sustainable with how we carry out in not just using throwaway bits of equipment. So that was another one that really stood out to me, as I thought, that's, you know, that's a real smart. There was something in the digital innovation category as well from Kier, how they're looking to integrate the whole base SI software and AutoCAD and really try to push this digital agenda and capturing data from the offset, which comes all the way back around to collecting and carrying out good site investigation at the beginning of a project, and how us as ground engineering contractors, the better the SI, the better the data, you know, the solution will only be stronger for clients in the future. So I thought that was great that that was getting showcased as well. What about yourself?
Yeah, well, there's so much stuff in there. And I think sometimes when you have these dinners and these awards events, sometimes you get caught up in the moment of meeting people. Actually, you can lose sight of some of the fantastic stuff that's going on out there. And maybe this sort of situation that we're in will actually give us time to pause and reflect on the quality of the entries themselves and what's involved. And something that caught my eye, again, unsurprisingly, I suppose, from a sustainability, environmental sustainability perspective, was the hollow pile. So Kelpray, you know, they've been flying the flag over the last few years, really, on some of their sustainability work. And you know, I thank them for that. And they're actually going to lead some work within the FPS on sustainability. They've volunteered to lead our route to zero carbon group within the FPS. They've been working on a hollow pile. Now, I need to find out a few more details, but I've done a little bit of research. And the principle is that you get as much shaft friction and end bearing capacity from basically having a pile with an empty core in it. So the geotechnical capacity is still the same, but you're not using anywhere near as much carbon because there's not as much concrete going in because you've got this big void, which I'm not entirely sure what they fill it with. Maybe soil, it would make sense. And yeah, less CO2, less cost. It seems a brilliant idea. And then when I was Googling it, I noticed that our next guest, Nirmal, has been involved in something very similar before. And I think there is a case of sometimes these ideas come up and the world's just not quite ready for them. And what we're coming into now is an environment where people are more prepared to embrace this sort of technology. So let's bring in Nirmal and find out a little bit more about the hollow pile, about some of the work that he was doing with Siesta and the carbon calculator back 10, 15 years ago. Tell us about it.
Just going back to the hollow pile, it was a brainchild of Tony Suckling, and he actually joined hands with the City University. And 10 years ago, City University applied for a patent which was called City Shore. Now, Shore actually equates to sustainable reusable pile. I don't know, I did try and search in Google whether they have actually got the patent yet, and how, if it is exactly the same method that Kelbury are using, whether they will be allowed to use that or not. So that is my first question. Basically, at that time, what we were doing is we did a couple of tests for the City University, which was organized through Tony Suckling. We built the pile, which was a 1.2 meter diameter pile, using a temporary casing down to the clay level, and then boring the pile right down to the toe level, and then installing an 800 millimeter permanent casing inside the hollow pile, right down to the toe of the pile, which was designed to have load factors of 4,500 kilonewton. That was the design load of that pile. And we did some trials and tested the piles to 800 tons. One pile was constructed using normal concrete and steel, and the other one was a hollow pile. So the hollow pile was constructed, after putting the permanent casing, which was 800 diameter, we concreted the pile to the base for the bottom 1 meter to get the end resistance. And then the rest of the pile was filled in with the annulus of the pile was filled in. See what I mean? And that was quite a tricky operation because we had to make sure that the concrete, you know, the annulus is fully concreted and there were no arching of the concrete.
Okay, so you had the steel casing, so you filled in the annulus with concrete, and then what did you backfill the void in the middle of the tube with?
Yeah, the central hole was left as it is, because the main idea with that was that if in future we had to rebuild if we have to increase the load on the pile, we could still go back and drill the pile to a deeper depth and reuse that pile for higher loads. So that was one big advantage. The other advantages that we had using that pile was reduced concrete, as we already discussed, because we are only filling the annulus rather than the full pile. And the access, and the obviously what I just discussed, is the access to extend the pile at a later date. The use of the void could be used for ground source heat pumps. That is why the void was left open. So we could use it for that, or also use it for storing rainwater. So we could harness the rainwater in that hole and use it for whatever internal supply of the building, water to the building. However, we found out, I did some trials, which are listed in the paper on sustainability, which was presented to the FPS and EFFC and DFI in May 2010, the London Exhibition Centre, where we did two pros and cons of two scenarios. We did one hollow pile and one solid pile. The solid pile was 1.2 meter diameter. It was 30 meters deep. Both the piles were 30 meters deep. But what we found there was that the hollow pile, although it was supposed to be lower in carbon footprint, but as it turned out, it came to be more expensive and it was more there were more carbon footprinting in that hollow pile. The reason was that at that time, because you've got a permanent casing in the pile, so the steel added quite a lot of carbon footprint to that particular pile. But, you know, these are the figures that we were given by Knives at that time. Because if you use virgin steel, you can get 2.7 tons of carbon per ton of steel. Whereas with recycled steel, you could get 0.4 ton of carbon per ton of steel. The carbon footprinting of this pile was calculated using 1.72 tons of carbon per ton of steel.
Okay. But I think it's worth reiterating that point, though, that the theory was great that you're using less concrete, but in practice, because of the steel that was being used, and maybe there were other products available, maybe, I don't know if the Kelpbray one uses precast concrete rather than steel, maybe there is a way to actually be more efficient, and that's the only way forward. You've got to save carbon, but it's got to be cheaper as well, otherwise nobody's going to buy the product. So that explains why we've not seen more of that. But you're also you were doing a lot of work in terms of carbon calculation, weren't you? And there was a tool at Stent.
I was involved with the carbon footprinting. What we did, I was involved initially with the development of Siesta, which was not the afternoon nap, of course, it was the Stent integrated estimating application. Both Siesta and Green Siesta were programs that were developed by Jason Scott a colleague of mine in Stent. My task was to provide the guidance in terms of how we wanted each of the estimating programs for the various techniques to be developed. This was developed to get rid of Conquest, which when they started charging money for each dongle that we had to use, and we have 10 estimators, it was costing the company quite a lot. And with the Excel sheet, it was very difficult to have the estimator traced as to who actually did the estimate, who actually made the changes to that estimate. So CSR was therefore created, and I got heavily involved in developing that estimating system. When the estimating system was finished, we then started the Green Siesta, which was linked to the estimate, and it was done in a way that we had minimal input from the estimator, because, you know, if you have additional work, then people don't do it. If it is automatically done in the background, then that is the way forward, which is what we did. I know FPS is also doing their have come out with a program. It's not a problem, it's that we have to, after doing the estimate, the estimator has actually got to put in all those quantities. Whereas with Siesta, Green Siesta, as we call it, those figures automatically come from the background. It is programmed in such a way.
Yeah, I think you've got to make it easy for people, haven't you? You know, it's got to be, as you say, integrated into your pricing software. And if it's not taking any more time, then why not produce it? What about the client views on it? Did that change? So Siesta was formed back in...
Well, 2004 we started, and by 2008 it was complete and running. And we did quite a lot of tests, relative testing with the old Excel sheets that we were using and then the old Conquest that we were using. And once we got the comparisons absolutely bang on, we then got rid of Conquest, we got rid of all the Excel spreadsheets. And with Siesta, we can actually identify who did the estimate, because no other estimator could override that estimate. So we knew exactly what time the estimate was prepared, how it was prepared, who prepared it, and when.
But what I'm really interested in is how's the appetite changed over that 12-year period of since 2008 of it being used in estimating at BBGE. What's the market been like? Have people started to change in the last few years, and actually they're taking that information, that carbon tonnage, and appreciating that within their tender analysis or not?
Well, they are doing it. When I was there, and we actually used to present to the client the different options of a piling solution. For example, we did a job where we did a pricing with the precast piles and the pricing with the CFA pile. And then we produced the carbon footprint. And because it was so easy to produce, we presented to the client the price and the pie chart for both the CFA pile and the precast pile, which clearly showed the savings in the carbon footprint, not only the savings in the cost, but also the saving in the carbon footprint. And that was the time when the government was trying to put a lot of pressure on the various contractors and the industry that we need to reduce the carbon footprint. And that was quite good, because some of the main contractors used that to show their client, look, this is what we're doing, this is how much carbon footprint we're saving using this precast pile. It's saving you not only money, but also the carbon footprinting on that project. The carbon emission factors was provided by NIFES, the National Industrial Fuel Efficiency Service. And for the transport of plant, cages and concrete, the figures were provided by the National Atmospheric Emission Inventory.
Well, hopefully now with BREEAM and SEQUAL and the requirements around major project procurement, this is going to be more and more appreciated by clients, and we're going to see more environmental value put into projects. Now you've, I suppose, coming towards the end of your career, you're semi-retired, aren't you? I think after 50 years in the industry.
To the end of my career, because it's time for me to seek fresh and challenging opportunities to continue my passion in the wider range of the piling and foundation industry. I mean, we started off when I was using slide rule in the college, or mathematical calculations and facet machines to grind the numbers out, then telex for communication, and now we're on to calculators, computers, and emails. I certainly don't have a desire to retire, nor to rest on my oars, but to paddle on full speed ahead.
That's brilliant to hear that we're not losing such skills to the industry. I mean, let's hear a little bit more about your journey, because you were born in India and studied there initially. How did you come to be working in the UK?
Well, I started my career when I did my schooling, which was the O levels, because at that time we didn't have the A levels. That schooling was done with in St. Columbus High School, which was run by the Irish Brothers at that time. After that, I sat for two entrance exams. One was for the National Defence Academy, which would have taken me to a career in the Army. The NDA is very similar to the SANDERS that we have in the UK. And the other exam that I sat for was the IIT. There are five IITs in India. They're one of the best colleges, engineering colleges in the country. I studied from IIT Delhi, which was affiliated to the Imperial College in London. That was a five-year degree course. And I had a professor in soil mechanics who had just come from MIT after finishing his stint in the States. He was an excellent professor, and he was the one who really influenced me in the subject of soil mechanics. So we were reading books by Carl Terzaghi and Ralph Beck, who were the gurus of soil mechanics at that time. The books from Tomlinson and Fleming came much later. So on graduation, I did a small job in a construction site, but construction was not really my forte. I really wanted to get back into piling. So in 1972, I saw an advertisement in the national newspaper by Cementation, which was affiliated to Cementation in UK. At that time, it was Trevor Philpott who was at the helm. I was interviewed at the Qutb Minar site by the head of the drilling and grouting department. The Qutb is a 72.5-meter brick minaret, which is the tallest in the world, and it took over 28 years to build. Started in 1193. It tapers from 15 meters to 2.5 meters at the top, spreading over five stories. It began to lean. The tilt was not as much as that of Pisa, but the inclination to join Cementation was. Cementation were carrying out permeation grouting to the 3 meter deep foundations to prevent the rainwater from entering granular soils. My enthusiasm seen during the site visit after the interview got me the job. So that was my start with the piling industry. We started off with the training regime with all the departments, with site investigation first, and then drilling and grouting for a dam in Gujarat in West India, where we had to do injection, pressure, and consolidation grouting. Then was involved in a diaphragm wall project. And since this was the first time that diaphragm wall was being carried out by Cementation India, Cementation in UK sent their top expert called Tommy Law to oversee the project. After that, I was involved in the installation of 2,500 precast piles in pre-bored holes. This is a very unique type of piling where we had, and I've never seen it being done anywhere else since. In those days in India, we had very little foreign currency and foreign equipment. So labor was cheap. So these were installed, the piles were done, bored using tripod rigs. Pile lengths are varying from 15 to 27 meters long. So we bored the pile using the tripod rig and the sludge pump down to the depth. And then we installed precast concrete piles. These were octagonal in shape. And the precast piles had a tube running right through it for flushing the pile and then grouting it. The base was chamfered to prevent the blocking at the bottom when the pile rests on the ground. So that was quite an interesting project. And this was the brainchild of Zim Silvinsky of Cementation UK. He was 75 years at that time, so still inventing things.
So you talked about you did a diaphragm wall in the early 70s. What was it like building a D-wall back then? I mean, I've seen the equipment that's used now, and I know there'll be listeners keen to understand how you built a D-wall back in the 70s?
Well, it was obviously we didn't have hydrophrases or anything. I mean, it was a simple grab that we were using. Nothing complicated at that time. It was, you know, just do the trench, do the guide wall, and do the stop ends. I mean, stop end, obviously, at that time, even now, it is quite tricky. And I come to one of the problems I faced when I came to the UK. So that is how we were doing it. And then Tommy Law, even though he was given a first-class hotel to stay in, he liked the surroundings of the site so much that he pitched up a tent and stayed there on the site for 24 hours. The diaphragm wall works have been carried out throughout the night. It was a 24-hour shift. So he really loved it, and he was very, very helpful to the team, and you know, gave a lot of his knowledge to the local people in India at that time.
And did I see that you got lowered down a D-wall?
Well, yes, that was in the UK. I'll come to that. This is about the last precast pile job. I mean, the precast piling, that was quite interesting because I've never seen that before. And after loading the precast pile, we just flushed it, and then using Colmoro pumps and concrete mixers, we grouted the pile and just stopped the grout as it went down and then pulled the casing out. These are only short casings. This helped in a way because it saved a lot of concreting time. And also because of the clay after 5 or 6 meters, it was very difficult to use driven precast piles on the job. So this was a very good idea of Slavinsky to have this technique used.
So now, Mel, you were involved in one of the largest schemes in the UK, which was the construction of the Barbican. Can you tell us a bit more about that particular project?
Yeah, I was actually involved after finishing the project in Mangalore, the fertilizer plant where we did precast piles in pre-bored holes. Tarmac UK at that time were looking for civil engineers because in 1974 there was a shortage of civil engineers in the UK. So I was lucky enough to be one of the 25 people to be elected. So I left the UK at that time with just a fiver that was allowed by the Indian government because of the shortage of foreign currency. And the first job that I had was in the Barbican Arts Theatre, where the diaphragm wall had already been completed. And there were some remedial works that had to be carried out. This was because of the T-shaped panels, which were these stop ends. There were some clay intrusions at the nib, and these had to be cleared because the water was seeping through them. The way we were doing that was lowering a man with a mesh opening in a cage with a full high-pressure water jet and going down and cleaning the intrusions. And then once that was done, it filled up the hole with grout.
That's pretty scary. What year was that?
That was in 1974.
Gosh. And how far down are we talking about here? How deep in the ground?
The wall was about 14, 15 meters.
Is that?
So gosh. We had to go down to about 13 meters at least.
So the cohesionless ground, that's all been supported by casing, and then you're lowered below that, and there's some sort of gravelly clay, is there, that you're trying to...
The ground was quite stable as well, mm-hmm. below the top 5 or 6 meters of gravel, and that was sealed with an external casing.
And how deep was the basement there?
Sorry, there was not hardly any space, you know, 800 millimeter inside the casing.
Yeah. How deep was the basement? Are we talking a sort of four-story basement in the Barbican? I can't...
Yeah, three stories. I think in those days, I don't think they did those deep basements.
Yeah, interesting. And then from one high-profile scheme to another huge one, which is an icon really in civil engineering terms, was the Burj, the hotel in Dubai, which I think we'll all recognise by the sail shape, and that's one of the biggest and probably most expensive hotels in the world. I imagine the piles are pretty big there too.
Yeah, the piles. After I had, I came back to UK after my stint in this first 9 years. I was in Dubai in the Middle East. I worked in Bahrain, Qatar, Saudi Arabia with Stent for the first 9 years. And then in 1988, there was a slump in the Middle East and we closed down the operations. And then I was asked to come and join a stint in the UK. So I was involved with various projects in the UK at that time, the M11 project at that time, and then the M4 extension. And then when the Bulgaria in 1973, I was asked to, by Tony Merrickson, 1974 actually, at Christmas time, I was asked by Tony Merrickson, the chairman at that time, to prepare a tender for the Bulgaria Arab Hotel. And obviously at Christmas time, there was only myself, and Tony Merrickson was used to come once in a day to just go through what I was doing in terms of getting the tender ready. The tender submission was on the 1st of January, 1995. So we slogged through and got the tender approved by Tony, sent it off. It was a very confidential tender. We were not supposed to tell anyone about this job because it was, you know, belonging to the ruler of Dubai. So once we, and we were lucky enough to be successful. So
that's always a difficult moment, isn't it? I think as an estimator, David will appreciate this as well. You've won the job. Oh, God, are we too cheap? Certainly with something as challenging as that scheme, you must have thought that.
Yeah, I mean, Tony Merrick's obviously, you know, really asked me a lot of questions on how I got through various things and where I got the prices from, because we were not even allowed to get prices from Dubai. I was sitting in UK. We had to price a job in the Middle East. It was not easy. But because I had the 9-10 years experience in the Middle East, it was quite easy for me to at least gauge and have an idea of what the material prices would be at that time. So that was quite a bonus for me. And luckily it was an Atkins design, so there was no design involved in that. Otherwise it would have been difficult to get a designer to do the pile design. The piles were 1.5 meter diameter, 55 meters deep. And we had to drill through conglomerates, calcium siltites, which is a type of limestone, down to 55 meters depth. I mean, it took us a full 24-hour shift. We had six soil mech rigs working 24 hours a day and four cranes to support the rigs. Each pile took about 100 cubic meters of concrete, and because of the 40 degree centigrade heat, we had to use chilled aggregates and iced water and special plasticizers to ensure that the good quality tremie was used. So,
as one estimator to another, you know, if someone had put that on my desk the day before Christmas, I'd have probably had a meltdown. I mean, how at that stage of your career do you go about tackling something like that when, like you say, you're in the UK, you've got a project in extreme heat and you know you need to make allowances? What's that process that you went through at that time to get to a point where you're then successful in building such an iconic building?
Well, because of my experience, as I said, I had spent 9 years in Dubai before I came to UK and then went back to Dubai. The main reason I was sent back to Dubai was to, because I had all the contacts with suppliers, I had all the contacts with various subcontractors, so I could actually reconnect with them. And most importantly, I knew the sponsor there, which is Dutko Balfabiti, which is a local company. So that was quite a big advantage for me. And having known the prices when I left in 1988, okay, it was quite, you know, a bit later after that, but I used some factors. But what we told, this was attended to Dutko Balfabiti, and we told Balfabiti that these are the prices that we are using because we have been asked not to approach any suppliers. So any changes in those figures will have to be compensated accordingly. But these are the volumes, these are the tonnages, and the labor and plant was obviously ours, so we knew what it was. And within the UK, we were able to get prices from for shipping companies because we had to ship all the rigs. So I had to include all that in our price. And that was not easy because Christmas time, everything was shut in the UK.
So you've created the rug for your own back though, didn't you? Because you then had to go out there and manage the thing, which must have been, first of all, from a temperature point of view, like extremely hard work. But Also, how do you communicate? We've got people from all around the world. I don't know what language you would have spoken.
My experience of working in the 9 countries gave me the knowledge of working in varying ground conditions, besides the ability to deal with personalities from different backgrounds and variegated nationalities. I also learned the art of managing people with individual mindsets, besides realizing that patience really is a virtue. And with regards to the temperature, in where I come from in Delhi, the temperature goes up to 45 degrees in the summers, although it goes down to -1 in the winters. It's an extreme climate because we get the worst of the desert heat in the summer and the cold from the Himalayas in the winter. So temperature was not a problem. The side offices were all air-conditioned anyway, and we could get cold water and everything. And so I was quite familiar with using chilled aggregates and iced water in concrete, and obviously the ready-mix supply. And also the other thing we had to do was, the concrete drums had to be covered with wet hessian, using the principle of evaporation causes cooling. So that helped the concrete to be cool when it was being delivered.
So, Nirmal, you've mentioned you've spent a lot of your career working across different countries. I was just interested, from someone whose career's solely been in the UK, some of the good practices that you've seen from your time overseas. Like, what do you think we could learn in the UK from some of them?
Well, I think it was the other way around. I had to actually teach most of the, because these people haven't seen a rig. Some of the countries I went to, in Saudi Arabia, for example, we were employing local labor, and they had never seen a rig before, and so it was quite difficult. And because of the cost cutting, because an expat in overseas countries costs a lot of money, you have to provide him accommodation, food, and airfares every 6 months. And so we had to minimize the number of expats we could use in any project. So I, for example, in Saudi Arabia, I just had one foreman, one rig operator, and that was it. And all the labor we had to get from Dubai. Luckily, I had built up a team in Dubai when I was working there. So I got the same team and picked and chose the best people from a group of people whom I'd got along very well with and whom I'd trained quite well. So that made life quite simple. And the biggest problem I had was in Thailand. In Thailand, it's very, very difficult. Very few people, maybe now they do, but very few people at that time when I was there in the 1980s spoke English. I had to have a translator for every walk of life, a translator for attending meetings, translator on site, giving instructions to engineers, and all sorts of things, and even going into restaurants. The sign language didn't work for me because I was trying to, I ended up with all types of sauces that the restaurant had, when all I wanted was salt. So that was a disaster in my sign language. So I think it was us who were teaching them rather than learning lessons from them. But they were, everywhere I went, they were good learners, and they were quite interested because it was new to them, and they found that it was very interesting, the whole piling business.
The sign language for beer seems quite universal, though, doesn't it?
Yeah. But even ordering chicken legs by various signs, I ended up with chicken feet, just because chicken feet are a favorite recipe, food of the Thais. So okay. That even there, I went wrong.
Well, we've covered some exciting projects. You must be so proud to have been involved in some of those schemes. There must have been some significant individuals along the way that have helped you in your career. And I know that you're giving back by, as we mentioned earlier, getting involved in our mentoring scheme. What do you think makes a good mentor? And what examples have you seen in the past that have been really effective for you?
Well, I myself have done a lot of mentoring, basically because of Siesta. Once I had developed Siesta, it was my job to train all the estimators in the use of the Siesta system, So at that time, we had offices in Scotland and in Derby, and obviously the Stent office in the south. So I ended up training, going to Scotland to train estimators there. We had about a team of four estimators in Scotland, a team of six estimators in Derby, and then five or six estimators in the south. So that was part of the training scheme that I was involved in. And also then when we got Green Siesta, then training on Green Siesta. Also did a course in level three in from the Institute of Leadership and Management on workplace coaching, which helped me quite a lot because it told me the background of how the training has to be done. And I took a few examples and trained them the way that ILM, the Institute of Leadership and Management, wanted me to train, and then I had to write a report and send it to them before I got my level three.
Yeah, it's a soft skill, isn't it? But it's certainly something that you can learn. I mean, people talk about leadership and being a born leader. Well, that's not really the case. You know, we're all socially conditioned, but also we pick up practical skills along the way to develop and to show initiative and to provide structure as managers. And I think we can do the same thing as mentors, and listening obviously is a good skill. And we heard about that from our last guest, Andy Corbler. And I'm pleased to say, actually, I mentioned Andy, that podcast has been received extremely well. And if you're just tuning in for Nirmal's podcast, you might want to go back over Andy's one and several others as well.
I was myself a mentee, and it was Jim Duvall who was mentoring me for when he was the MD of Stent. And he was a great teacher, and I learned a lot of things from him.
Yeah, Jim's a great guy, isn't he? He's a fantastic character, one of the biggest characters within the pardon industry. I know he's very prominent now within Keller, but perhaps we'll be lucky enough to get him on one of these podcasts in the future. David, I think you had a question about the values as well.
Yeah, Nirmal, so I'm 10 years in the industry. I can already look back and go, you know, they're things that hold true to me. What sort of values have you retained throughout your career and then you've passed on to estimators, like you've explained about when you've been training them? What's some of them core values that you think is successful?
Well, the core value is firstly to keep your client happy by delivering the tenders, from my point of view, in time and with as good a quality submission as one can. And also making sure that from the company perspective, to make sure that the job will make money on site. And I was quite a hard worker, and I used to ensure that people who are under my training should try and emulate from that. Because hard work always pays, as everyone knows. Even if you don't have the brains, if you work hard, you know, that is the route to success in any field of life, not only engineering.
Wise words indeed there. And I think everybody listening can take something from that. Thank you so much for joining us today on the podcast. It's been great to hear about your career history and things that have made you the success that you are. My appreciation also goes to David for joining us as a guest and a co-host on this episode. Hope you've enjoyed listening. Don't forget to subscribe and to share. Next month's guest is a genuine celebrity. Mental health expert and comedian Ruby Wax will be talking to us. Thanks for listening.